Welcome to Washington Today for Friday, February 18th, 2022. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Following talks with NATO allies, President Biden gave an update on Russia-Ukraine tensions and international efforts to resolve the crisis peacefully. We'll hear from the president shortly. In Germany, more than 30 heads of state, including Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky and 100 government ministers, along with Vice President Kamala Harris and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, are attending the Munich Security Conference amid rising tensions over a possible Russian invasion of their neighbor, Ukraine. A notable absentee will be the country on everyone's mind, Russia. For the first time in two decades, there will be no Russian delegation. Meanwhile, spiking tensions in eastern Ukraine on Friday aggravated Western fears of a Russian invasion and a new war in Europe, with a humanitarian convoy hit by shelling and pro-Russian rebels evacuating civilians from the conflict zone. A car bombing hit the eastern city of Donetsk, but no casualties were reported. Ukrainian rebels have evacuated civilians to Russia amid the crisis. Western leaders say an escalation in the fighting in Ukraine's Donbass region, which has simmered for almost 8 years, could be part of Russian efforts to create a false flag pretext to invade. We'll have more on the situation there in just a moment. And with our neighbors to the north, Canadian police have been arresting protesters and towing away trucks in Ottawa in a bid to break the three-week traffic-snarling siege of Canada's capital by hundreds of truckers angry over the country's COVID-19 restrictions. We'll have updates with Wall Street Journal reporter Paul Vieira. We begin now at the White House, where President Biden updated the nation on the administration's response to the tension between Russia and Ukraine.
Over the last few days, we've seen reports of a major uptick in violations of the ceasefire by Russian-backed fighters attempting to provoke Ukraine and the Donbas. For example, a shelling of a Ukrainian kindergarten yesterday, which Russia has falsely asserted was carried out by Ukraine. We also continue to see more and more disinformation being pushed out to the Russian public, including Russian-backed separatists, claiming that Ukraine is planning to launch a massive offensive attack in the Donbas. Well, look, there is simply no evidence in these assertions, and it defies basic logic to believe the Ukrainians would choose this moment, with well over 150,000 troops arrayed on its borders, to escalate a year-long conflict. Russia's state media also continues to make phony allegations of a genocide taking place in the Donbas and push fabricated claims warning about Ukraine's attack on Russia without any evidence. That's just what I'm sure Ukraine's thinking of doing, attacking Russia. All of these are consistent with the playbook the Russians have used before, to set up a false justification to act against Ukraine. This is also in line with the pretext scenarios that the United States and our allies and partners have been warning about for weeks. Throughout these tense moments, the Ukrainian forces have shown great judgment and, I might add, restraint. They refuse to allow the Russians to bait them into war. But the fact remains, Russian troops currently have Ukraine surrounded from Belarus along the Russian border and with Ukraine to the Black Sea in the south and all of its border. You know, look, we have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people. We're calling out Russia's plans loudly and repeatedly, not because we want a conflict, but because we're doing everything in our power to remove any reason that Russia may give to justify invading Ukraine and prevent them from moving. Make no mistake, if Russia pursues its plans, it will be responsible for a catastrophic and needless war of choice. The United States and our allies are prepared to defend every inch of NATO territory from any threat to our collective security as well. We also will not send troops in to fight in Ukraine, but we will continue to support the Ukrainian people. This past year, the United States provided a record amount of security assistance to Ukraine to bolster its defensive, $650 million from Javelin missiles to ammunition. We also previously provided $500 million in humanitarian aid and economic support for Ukraine. And earlier this week, We also announced an additional sovereign loan guarantee of up to $1 billion to strengthen Ukraine's economic resilience.
Speaking from the White House Roosevelt Room, President Biden giving an update on the situation between Russia and Ukraine. We continue now in Germany, where world leaders are meeting this weekend for the annual Munich Security Conference, which will be dominated by the Ukraine crisis, as major Western powers warn that the Kremlin looks close to launching an invasion of the former Soviet state. At the closing of Friday's session of the Munich Security Conference, Mayor of Kyiv Vitaly Klitschko addressed U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. We begin with the Mayor of Kyiv.
We're ready to defend our families, our states, our cities, our citizens. We need support. Thank you for 5,000 helms, but not enough. We can't defend our country. What just with that. And also, very important point, come back to 1996 Budapest Agreement. Ukraine in 1996 was third country in the world with largest nuclear weapons. We give up our nuclear weapons with a guarantee. United States, French, Great Britain, and Russia make a guarantee of our independence and territorial integrity. It's not so much time in the past. Right now, what about the Budapest Agreement? Everybody forget about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You have already responded to the question of delivery of weapons, so maybe Tony would like to say a few words there.
Mr. Mayor, first of all, it's good to see you, and I appreciate not only the substance of your words, but also the emotion behind them. And here's what I can tell you, just speaking on behalf of the United States. When it comes to security assistance, as you know, in the last year alone, we provided about $650 million in defensive lethal assistance, more in the last year than in any previous year. We continue to provide that assistance. I personally authorized some of our partner countries who had American-made equipment to transfer that to Ukraine, Baltic countries, and we're continuing to do everything that we can with other partners to help you provide for your defense. At the same time, I'm convinced that the work that we are doing together to bring countries, not just in Europe, but beyond Europe, together, and making very clear to Russia that if it commits renewed aggression against Ukraine, there will be, as we've said, and I quote, massive consequences. This is what the G7 countries said together. The European Union, NATO, the power of that deterrent and our solidarity, I remain hopeful will have an impact. But the other thing that I think is so important, and it's why more and more countries beyond Europe and beyond the United States are focused on this now, and I heard this at the Security Council yesterday, is I think there's a growing recognition that what is happening in Ukraine matters first and foremost to Ukrainians, but should matter to everyone in the world. Because what's at stake, first, yes, are the lives and well-being of Ukrainians, but what's at stake are larger principles that are the foundation of the entire international order, an order established after two world wars and a Cold War, with some basic principles that are necessary to maintain peace and security. And those principles are being challenged right now by Russia in Ukraine. Principles like you can't change the borders of another country by force. Principles like you can't dictate to another country its choices, its decisions, its policies, including with whom it will associate. Principles like you cannot exert a sphere of influence to subjugate neighbors to your will. In different ways, complementary ways, but I believe powerful ways, countries are standing up for Ukraine and for the principles that are at stake. So we will continue to do everything we can for you, with you, and with our partners.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Mayor of Kyiv Vitaly Klitschko at the Munich Security Conference in Germany. Meanwhile, here in Washington, D.C., former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo discussed nuclear strategy and deterrence in a conversation hosted by the Center for the National Interest. Here's what he had to say when asked about Russia.
What is Russia's goal in Ukraine, in your mind?
In some ways, I think they've already achieved part of their goal. All right, one of Putin's central theses is to the extent he can disconnect Europe from the United States and European countries from each other. I think he views that all to the good. And you've seen that fractured nature, certainly the fractured nature inside of Europe, where those who are most physically and kinetically connected to Russia take a line that is very different than Germany and France. So I think check the box one. I think Putin thinks the continued pressure, essentially, what I think about is the encirclement of Ukraine has driven that first objective. That first objective is connected to the way he thinks about the world, right? It's a little trite now, but very true. He does believe that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was a calamity, right? The worst one of the 20th century. I considered it as a small part of it. I was a platoon leader in Germany. I consider it one of the greatest achievements of my life. He has the reverse or the inverse view of that. And so it is the case, whether it's in Georgia or in Central Asia, what we saw, right, Russian involvement in the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, what they did in Kazakhstan. We forgot just a handful of weeks ago, Russia deployed troops to Kazakhstan, you know, peacekeepers to Kazakhstan. This is all part and parcel of Putin's effort to secure and control his near abroad. Look, we shouldn't be foolish. That's something that the next leader of Russia is going to want to do as well, right? Threats on your border are a serious business. But it is also the case that it is equally foolish to acknowledge that Putin's claim to feel threatened by NATO or threatened by Ukraine is largely nonsensical. I think most of the world knows. She certainly knows it too. The West has no intention of crossing the Western Russian border. And so when he raises this threat, his concerns, and even the extended threat that says he raises concerns about, ill treatment of Russians in Ukraine, this is silly on its face. The worst treatment of Russians actually happens inside of his own country. And so so to think that he's trying to protect the human rights of the Russian people and the ethnic rights of the Russian people in Ukraine is just a great storyline. And frankly, you see on the right in America and on the progressive left in America, you say it works. It gets a little bit of a foothold. So I think those are the objectives of Putin. I think he's going to continue with those objectives. And the United States has a capacity and a deep interest in pushing back against his achievement of each of those objectives.
Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a virtual discussion at the Center for the National Interest. In Poland, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and his Polish counterpart Mariusz Błaszczyk held a joint news conference in Warsaw amid rising tensions over possible Russian invasion of Ukraine. Here's what he had to say.
Yesterday, although Russia has announced that it is moving its forces back to garrison, we have yet to see that. In fact, we see more forces moving into that region, that border region. And we also see them going through, continuing to prepare by doing things that you would expect military elements to do as they were preparing to launch an attack. So it includes a number of things in terms of moving closer to the border, dispersal of troops, increasing logistical capabilities. And so, again, all of the indicators continue to indicate that, he will maintain the capability to launch an attack at most any time. We haven't seen any evidence of him moving his forces away from the border.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. The U.S. has given preliminary approval for a sale of $6 billion worth of battle tanks and other equipment to Poland as the U.S. continues to bolster NATO's defense capabilities along the alliance's eastern flank. Speaking to reporters from Poland, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin also said that the procurement will, quote, help to ensure a more equitable sharing of responsibilities within the alliance for a common defense. Secretary Austin said the time frame for delivery of the tanks is still under discussion. Meanwhile, the U.S. has sent a total of 4,700 troops stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to Poland to help assure the alliance. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba with more headlines. The Biden administration released a screening tool to help identify disadvantaged communities long plagued by environmental hazards. But the screening tool excludes race as a factor in deciding where to devote resources. The Associated Press reports the administration officials told reporters that excluding race will make projects less likely to draw legal challenges and will be easier to defend, even as they acknowledge that race has been a major factor in terms of who experiences environmental injustice. The decision was harshly challenged by members of the environmental justice community. A new bill in California would allow private citizens to go after gun makers in the same way Texas lets them target abortion providers. Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, on Friday backed legislation that would let private citizens enforce the state's ban on assault weapons. It's modeled after a Texas law that lets private citizens enforce that state's ban on abortions once a fetal heartbeat is detected. The Associated Press reporting that Governor Newsom said, quote, if Texas can use a law to ban a woman's right to choose and to put her health at risk, we will use that same law to save lives and improve the health and safety of the people in the state of California. The California Democratic governor spoke to reporters at a news conference Friday. President Joe Biden signed a short-term government funding bill into law, preventing a government shutdown just hours before the deadline to do so. The legislation will keep the government running through March 11th. Lawmakers hope to reach a long-term spending agreement during those 3 weeks. Minnesota Republican Representative Jim Hagedorn has died of kidney cancer. His wife Jennifer Carnahan made the announcement Friday morning on Facebook. Hagedorn announced a recurrence of kidney cancer last July and had tested positive for COVID-19 last month. House Chaplain Margaret Kibben spoke of him during the House opening prayer.
Would you pray with me? Holy and eternal God, we pause today, united in our grief at the loss of Congressman Jim Hagedorn, representative of Minnesota's 1st District. Those whom he served and we who have known him have been graced by a gracious man. Through his love of country and of Minnesota, you have inspired us by this public servant who grasped confidently and courageously his life's dream to serve others while serving you. We ask that you give comfort to his wife, Jennifer Carnahan, as she endures a broken heart and a shattered spirit. May she know that you hold her firmly in your tender embrace in these days of sadness. Bless those who served with him. May they be sustained by the faith that Representative Hagedorn claimed as the source of his strength throughout his life and in his recent battle with cancer. May Representative Hagedorn's legacy of service to this country, his heartfelt dedication to the ideals he held strongly, and his faithfulness to you serve as an inspiration to each of us. And may his memory be a blessing to all. We offer this prayer upheld in your most holy name. Amen.
House Chaplain Margaret Kibben. The late 59-year-old Representative Jim Hagedorn is the third House member to die during the 117th Congress. Representative Ron Wright, Republican of Texas, and Representative Alcee Hastings, Democrat of Florida, died last year. Also, Representative-elect Luke Letlow, Republican of Louisiana, died in December 2020 from complications related to COVID-19 after being elected but was never sworn in. The new breakdown in the House is 433 members now, 222 Democrats, 211 Republicans. There are two vacancies, Hagedorn's seat and the seat of former Representative Devin Nunes, Republican of California, who resigned.
Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you!
Canada Parliament cancels session as police clamp down on Freedom Convoy protesters. That's the headline at WSJ.com. On the phone with us, Wall Street Journal Ottawa Bureau reporter Paul Vieira. What's the latest with the truckers' protest there?
There's now a heavy presence of police officers in at least one part of the main protest zone. They've been successful in pushing back some of the protesters, clearing out some of the intersections. The officers are trying to surround a large group of protesters. We have seen some truckers who had been parked for weeks starting to leave now the protest zone, perhaps fearing that they'll get arrested. This is the culmination of a few days of warnings in which police have hand-delivered notes to some of the protesters, telling them they had to leave or else risked arrest.
And as you say that they had advance warning, we've heard previously in previous reports that these actions from police won't necessarily stop the truckers because we've heard that some of them say, we'll just come back. Is that what you're hearing?
There is some concern about whether or not, even if it clears out, whether they will try to return. In Windsor, Ontario, where truckers in a similar protest were able to block U.S.-Canada traffic, that protest was cleared, but the city reported this week that police there intercepted a would-be convoy that tried to restart the demonstration. So this is why the government has invoked some emergency powers that could go as long as 30 days. Probably the police and officials will argue they're probably going to need that full 30-day period in order to ensure that there is no repeat of what we've witnessed in Ottawa and elsewhere.
And your reporting noted that Canada Parliament cancels session as police are clamping down. What impact is that having?
It's very rare that Canada's Parliament cancels a sitting. The last time a sitting was cancelled was in October 2014 after an armed gunman entered the building. The Parliament came back the next day. Friday morning, lawmakers sent out a pretty stern warning that there's going to be no sitting due to the security risks, and officials told lawmakers and parliamentary aides to avoid the downtown area at all costs. So that was sort of maybe a tip-off or a prelude that something serious was going to happen Friday. Authorities were also very keen to stop these protests extending into what would be a fourth weekend. They didn't want any supporters from out of the city to come into Ottawa again and clog up the streets. It's also, as in the U.S., it's also a holiday weekend here. So I think they wanted to make clear that protesters were not welcome this weekend. And in Ottawa itself, the police have now set up a number of barriers and checkpoints to prevent people, unless they otherwise live or do business in the core of the capital, to not come downtown.
Wall Street Journal Ottawa Bureau reporter Paul Vieira, please give us some context. What does this mean for the average American?
These protests got on the radar of the White House. Rather unusually, we saw the Biden administration lean heavily on Canadian officials to get these protests under control and use whatever powers were necessary to do it. The big thing, of course, was this protest, a copycat protest or a protest in sympathy, whatever we want to call it, in which a few dozen people with their vehicles were able to mostly block U.S.-Canada trade at the Ambassador Bridge, which is one of the biggest border crossings in North America and is a key conduit for trade for the auto industry. Vehicle assembly plants in Canada need parts from the States in order to assemble those vehicles. So there was a lot of concern about how that Ambassador Bridge protest blockade could exacerbate an already tenuous supply chain network and affect the economy in the U.S. Midwest.
Wall Street Journal Ottawa Bureau reporter Paul Vieira, thank you so much for the update.
You're very welcome.
The vetting continues for a Supreme Court nominee to replace Justice Stephen Breyer, who will retire at the end of this term. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki updated reporters on the administration's timeline.
Go ahead.
Did you accidentally leave off of the week ahead the president's interviews of Supreme Court candidates?
Very good. I was like, I'm thinking maybe I left something off. Well, I can tell you that February is not that much longer. It's 10 days, if my math is correct. And we remain on track to make an announcement about the president's selection for a qualified and credible nominee to serve on the Supreme Court before the end of the month.
Okay, and then that was my following question. Go ahead. Which is that given what seems poised to go on with Ukraine, is there any thought that if there is an invasion, the president would delay the announcement of the Supreme Court pick, given, you know, what else could be going on at the time?
Well, you know, I love hypotheticals, but what I will tell you is that he has every intention of making a decision this month. He's on track to do so. That will mean he will have chosen a nominee faster than any Democratic president in decades. And obviously, he's somebody who has to, as leader of the free world and president of the United States, conduct business on a number of fronts at the same time.
From the White House, James Brady Briefing Room, Press Secretary Jen Psaki. The headline at Politico.com, Biden's SCOTUS shortlist staffs up to handle the media barrage. On the phone is White House reporter for Politico, Christopher Catalago. President Biden has promised to name a black woman to the Supreme Court by the end of February. Christopher Catalago, what's the latest?
So the White House is sticking by that timeline. Obviously, we know the State of the Union is coming up. These are some big deadlines that the White House has set for itself. And they are standing by that. What they are not getting into and engaging in is kind of the granular detail about the process that us and the media are so interested in, which is, you know, who all are they officially interviewing? They have confirmed that one of the judges under consideration is Michelle Childs of South Carolina. And the only reason they did that was because she had had a hearing that was delayed in the Senate. And so they kind of needed to explain why that hearing was delayed. So they did confirm her. The others are more under the banner of speculation. We reported at Politico this week that a number of public relations professionals in the industry in Washington and around the country are helping out with a few others, suggesting that, you know, they are part of the process. They include Leandra Kruger of the Supreme Court in California, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson of the court in D.C., she having some representatives helping her out. So, you know, that's really the extent of what we know. The White House has not said when these interviews have taken place, if they've taken place. They did say President Biden planned to do them this week. And aside from his trip to Ohio, he's had a pretty light schedule. So that's the assumption on our part, but we don't know.
And there have been public spectacle, public scrutiny over the nomination. What is the White House doing about that?
So in the case that some of the speculation and even, you know, criticism has come up that has merited it, we have heard from the White House. We heard from the White House when they were asked directly about some comments that Senator Ted Cruz had made about President Biden's pledge to nominate a black woman to the court. The White House said in response to that that Senator Ted Cruz did not have an issue when Donald Trump, the former president, had nominated Amy Coney Barrett to the court, pledging that he would nominate a woman to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Roger Wicker, the senator, had made a comment about how this amounted to affirmative action. The White House pushed back against that. There have been some other criticisms, some from the left, of some of the judges, their records having to do with labor and some court cases. In at least two cases, the White House has pushed back on those for two different judges, something they see as kind of a fair approach to do, but one that doesn't, you know, get so deep into one judge that it looks that we can read the tea leaves and suggest that, oh, that's the person they're defending. And so that's the extent of engagement they've had. It's really when they've felt like they've been forced to respond not something that they put out proactively.
And what else is your reporting telling you about the implications of sexism or racism with regards to this would-be Supreme Court nominee?
There are a number of very active organizations that have lined up, places like Ultraviolet, several others that have organized to advance Black women in politics, who have put out everything from guidelines for the media on how to cover this nomination, how to cover a Black woman in this situation, which we did kind of see during the Veep Stakes and post Joe Biden picking Kamala Harris to be his vice president. Clearly, there's a lot of sensitivity around the issue. The White House is focused a lot on this idea that whomever they pick is going to be someone who is qualified for the position and someone who is in the mold of retiring Justice Stephen Breyer. And so there are a lot of sensitivities around the prep for this. This is something you've never seen before, never had in our country's history. And, you know, there's not a lot of tolerance on the part of the White House or Democrats or these outside groups in someone being held to a different standard than maybe a white man or a woman of another background has been so far.
White House reporter for Politico, Christopher Catalago, please give us some perspective on why your reporting on this is significant for the American public.
So I think part of it is we've had the last few go-arounds with the Supreme Court, which have been so, you know, frankly ugly and so acrimonious. And the idea that while this will not change the makeup of the court, you know, the ideological makeup of the court, it is a chance to see how bipartisan the vote might be. And so, you know, that's something that senators from both parties have told us they are hoping to see that process play out in a way that kind of returns to maybe a little bit more of a normal that we'd seen before, particularly around these court picks. And so that's really a test of the Senate. It's a test of whom Joe Biden picks potentially, and of the White House and of the whole approach that they're taking. And so I think, you know, there's data out there, there's polling out there suggesting that the American people do want to see more bipartisanship, do want to see more of a return to normal. It's very challenging now. There are not a lot of high-profile votes that are bipartisan. And so that's one of the tests here in this case, in addition to obviously the historical nature of it.
We've been speaking with White House reporter for Politico, Christopher Catalago. Find his headline, Biden's SCOTUS shortlist staffs up to handle the media barrage, at politico.com. Christopher Catalago, thank you for your time.
Of course. Thank you.
And finally, today, an update on a story we shared with you first on Monday. The U.S. Embassy announced Friday that Washington is lifting a ban on inspections of Mexican avocado, freeing the way for exports to resume. The suspension of inspections had threatened Mexico's $3 billion annual exports and raised the possibility of price increases for U.S. consumers. Ambassador Ken Salazar said in a statement that the decision came after Mexico and the United States agreed, quote, to enact the measures that ensure the safety of agricultural inspectors who are in charge of making sure Mexican avocados don't carry diseases or pests that would harm U.S. orchards. Mexico supplies about 92% of U.S. imports of the fruit. U.S. per capita consumption of avocados tripled since 2001 to 8 pounds per person in 2018. The Mexican harvest is January through March, while U.S. production runs from April to September. A reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington delivered daily right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Thanks for listening today to Washington Today. We will be back Tuesday, February 22nd. Enjoy President's Day weekend.